You're listening to KUAC FM in Fairbanks. The all-time high for this date was 34 degrees set in 1940. The all-time low minus 56 set in 1934. The normal high is minus 5, the normal low minus 22, for an average temperature of minus 14 degrees. Sunrise today at 10:35, sunset tonight at 3:26. That's a total of 4 hours and 51 minutes of daylight, and that is 5 minutes more than yesterday. The forecast for Fairbanks, flurries this afternoon, temperatures around 20. Tonight, decreasing clouds with a few flurries and a low of 0 to 10. For Sunday, partly cloudy, a high near 10 degrees. The outlook for Monday, partly cloudy skies. Currently, the barometer is at 30.08 and rising slowly. We have north winds at 4. Under cloudy skies, the current temperature in Fairbanks is 20 degrees. This is KUAC FM in Fairbanks. It's time now for the Home Fires Radio Show.
Good morning. Welcome to Home Fires Radio Show. I'm your host, Patty Kostelic, and very happy to have all of you joining us this morning for an interesting discussion about a new but growing field called sports medicine. Actually, it may not be that new, but certainly I think general public awareness is greater in the last couple of years and maybe heightened by recent Olympic coverage. With me in the studio are Rex Rundquist, who's a pediatrician and works with sports medicine specialties, Larry Brand, who is in charge of rehabilitation, and Carrie Keller, who's the director of sports medicine at the Denali Sports Medicine Center. Welcome.
Thank you.
Let's start, I suppose, by doing a group definition of sports medicine, which I would encourage all of you to participate. Why don't we start with you, Carrie, and just tell us how do you define that? What makes it different from other kinds of medicine?
Thanks so much for inviting us here, Patty. It's certainly a pleasure to join you this morning. Sports medicine can be defined in many ways, but one definition I find helpful is to speak of it as a group of specialists working together to maintain the health and the optimal performance of an athlete. And I think we have to define athlete quite broadly to include not only the Olympic athlete, the professional athlete, but even more importantly, the community athlete, the high school athlete, the recreational athlete, the housewife or businessman who plays some tennis on the weekends, who runs a few times a week, and to include some very special athletes as well, the female athlete and the specific problems that she has, the elderly athlete, and handicapped athletes as well. That's a growing area of participation that has its own special training and medical problems associated with it.
We seem to be in the midst of a real fitness emphasis in our society. You can't pick up a magazine without some article on fitness. And it seems to me that 5 years ago there weren't very many athletic clubs, and now it's the way. If you're a single person in a lot of cities, that's the way the bars are out. That's the way to meet people, is to go to your local athletic club and work out on the equipment and take a couple of classes and play racquetball or whatever. But there are obviously multi-million dollar clubs, establishments in every community, even real small ones.
It's really true. It's really part of our culture, the American culture.
Yes, I think, for a long time, sports has been a big thing in this country. But earlier, it was organized sports, especially the team sports and so on, that got a lot of emphasis. And not everyone participated.
Of us participated with a beer can in front of the TV. that was our involvement.
But I think something that has really changed a lot has been the running boom that came in the 1970s. and really popularized sports, with a lot of people getting them to participate in it, and then further generation of interest in their own bodies and how to train and remain fit.
Why do you think running captured the imagination and became so popular? I mean...
Well, certainly one of the things is that it's a relatively inexpensive sport, and it really conveniences the person in that they don't need a facility to go to, and that they can do it on their busy schedules and so forth and fit it in. So that's one of the basic reasons.
You don't need a partner. You don't need a court.
Right. It's very individualized. And although not everybody can exercise on their own and so forth, a great majority can. And, you know, it gives them that flexibility to go out and do it for their time.
I've known some runners, and it seems to be actually an addicting pastime. They get real depressed if they can't run, and I had a friend in New York who whose knees gave out. I don't know what that means exactly, but at any rate, his knees got sufficiently injured that he couldn't run anymore. He was told that he absolutely couldn't run, and he was depressed for months. Really depressed. You're nodding.
Sure, see that a lot. Exercise is not only helpful in a physical sense, but it's certainly a release of tension. A way of working out the emotional stresses that build up in your life, and that's much of the sort of source of satisfaction that athletes find in regular exercise. And so when someone is injured, such as your friend in the knee trouble, it's important that we not only address the problem of the injury, rehabilitation from the injury, but recognize the dependency that many athletes have on that regular exercise, and find some substitute activity for them which they can perform during this down period, during this rehabilitation time, which helps to satisfy the psychological aspect and benefits of the regular exercise. Larry, maybe you have some examples of the kind of things that you can substitute.
Certainly, exercises that are very continuous and rhythmic in nature, such as cycling activity and swimming activities. A machine that has become very popular here in Alaska has been the Nautic Track machine, where actually cross-country skiing can take place indoors as well. But an activity that's going to be continuous and rhythmic in nature, that's going to use large postural muscles of the body, some of the substitute activities that we use, cycling and swimming.
That was interesting to me. I just happened to read an article yesterday that said that cross-country skiing uses more calories they said 900 calories for an hour of cross-country skiing and 300 for an hour of aerobic exercise. That was surprising to me.
I think aerobics is the big word there. You asked a little earlier how the running boom got started in this country, and I think a lot of it had to do with the development of medical research at that time. There was a lot of interest in reducing cardiovascular risks, risk for heart attack and so on. And in the late 60s and early 70s, Kenneth Cooper in Texas did a lot of his work and research studies with aerobic exercise, which is just what we've been talking about here. Things like running, swimming, cross-country skiing, and I think that's where people got interested in it. They wanted to reduce their risks of disease that comes with inactivity.
It seems unlikely that anyone wouldn't know what the term aerobic means in this day and age, but why don't we define it so in case there is someone.
Basically it's exercise that takes place where you utilize oxygen at a rate where your body needs for it are not exceeded. In other words, you're using oxygen to generate your energy. Your body can also generate energy by what we call an anaerobic process, where oxygen isn't utilized. and you develop byproducts from that type of exercise, particularly lactic acid, that stresses your body and you tire much faster. So aerobic exercise is something you can continue for a long time.
I might give some examples of exercises that are either aerobic or anaerobic to help people relate to that on an individual basis. If you think of explosive, sudden power kinds of exercises, they tend to be anaerobic. The exercises which require more endurance from your heart and lungs, from the oxygen system of the body, tend to be aerobic. So like running, the cross-country work that you mentioned, swimming, bicycling, there are many activities which can be aerobic. And there's some guidelines for how those exercises should be designed, what kind of exercise program you should have to get maximal aerobic benefit out of the exercise. You know some guidelines that you can tell us about, Larry?
Sure. We look at frequency of exercise, and basically we recommend 3 to 5 days a week of aerobic activity for gains in the cardiovascular, cardiopulmonary system.
An hour?
As far as
do we have a time?
Yeah, as far as duration goes, usually it's a minimum of 15 minutes and up to about 60 minutes. We'll give you a good cardiovascular aerobic workout. As far as the intensity is usually related to the duration of activity. Usually aerobic activity, because of the importance of the duration, the intensity is usually of a low to moderate nature. There's been many formulas that people can use to measure their heart rate and so forth to maintain it at a steady state to receive aerobic benefit. One of the nice ways of doing that is to basically take 220 and minus your age from it and call that your maximum heart rate, and then go ahead and take anywhere between an intensity level of 60 to 85% of that 220 minus your age or your maximum heart rate, and maintain activity for 15 to 60 minutes, 3 to 5 days a week, at that pulse rate. And as I mentioned earlier, aerobic activity is usually continuous in nature. It's usually rhythmical, and it uses a lot of the large postural muscles of the body. That's why running is a very popular aerobic activity, as well as cycling and swimming.
Okay. There used to be exercise programs that people did in their homes, 15 minutes of exercise that included some deep knee bends and some sit-ups and so on and so forth. But the pace at which those exercise programs were conducted didn't necessarily get your heart pulse rate up. That was not an emphasis. I took a lot of modern dance when I was in college, and I don't ever remember, it was not conducted in the same way that an aerobic dance class is now, where they start at a slow pace and build up, and at the end of an intensive 8-minute routine have you take your pulse and make sure that you are getting that heart pumping and getting that aerobic effect. I would assume that doctors had something to do with our approach and our understanding of that. Why don't we back up a little bit before we get too far into this, and could you tell us a little bit, we'll start with you, Dr. Keller, about your background. You're an orthopedic surgeon, but we were talking a little before the show that you did some additional study that is related to the whole field of sports medicine. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, that's right. I do have complete basic training in orthopedic surgery, as every orthopedic surgeon does. But in addition to that, in the midst of my training, I became especially interested in sports medicine, in caring for, but even more so preventing, athletic injuries.
Is that because as an orthopedic surgeon you saw a lot of injuries that were the result of poor conditioning, or that there were the result of sports events?
That's certainly true, and what I was observing at the university level was that those injuries which did occur might well have been prevented had adequate screening of the athletes been performed ahead of time, and if the care that they received had been somewhat more immediate than what they were receiving. And so I came to spend several years taking care of university athletes in the Midwest, traveling with teams, working along with Larry Brand, caring for those athletes as he was the athletic trainer for about 20 varsity teams on the collegiate level at that time. And as time went on and I completed my basic training, I chose to do a fellowship in sports medicine, which is an extra year of training in the care of athletes, athletic injuries, prevention of those injuries, where you especially study athletic training and rehabilitation principles in an effort to prevent injuries and to help rehabilitate athletes back to their full potential athletic performance following an injury. So I did have the welcome opportunity to spend a year at the U.S. Olympic Committee's medical training site in Cincinnati during that year, and I'll tell you, that was a real pleasure. What a fun way to learn and have good experience at the same time.
Just the little bit of Olympic watching that I did, we really developed some very sophisticated technology that tells us what kind of stress and what kind of impact certain kinds of athletic performance have on the body. Some slow-mo motion photography that really shows us what the muscles are doing when an athlete is in performance and so on, that I think must have really changed the way the medical profession treats these things, works on preventing.
That's really true. And it's a good example of how if you are going to provide the best care for an athlete, that it really requires a number of specialists getting together, providing good training from a number of different perspectives to help that athlete out, using the good background of exercise physiologists, of biomechanical engineers, people like that, combined with more traditional medical specialties. And I think in sports medicine, we've seen in a big way a combination of traditional medical specialties with athletic trainers, people who really specialize in first aid and training of athletes. And that's what it takes, is that combined kind of program. And you know, those technological advances are very useful in making small changes in the training programs of the elite athlete. But those things may not be so commonplace for the average community athlete. Let me give you an example of an example where technology is so useful, so applicable to the more average community athlete, the high school athlete, the recreational athlete. And that comes in the area of the question of when can I return to play after an injury? Or am I fully fit to begin this exercise program that I'm interested in doing? We now have the capacity to use computerized strength testing machines to actually measure the fitness of the body, to measure the rehabilitation of a body part after an injury, and use those very objective quantitative criteria to determine when little Johnny can go back and play youth league football again.
Without re-injuring that knee or putting further stress on it.
So we can do it with the most safety, and that decision can be based on actual measurements rather than on fairly subjective kinds of time periods, like 3 weeks after an ankle sprain, you can go back full, whereas some people might be ready then and some people might not. There's some real advances in the area of cardiac testing, cardiac rehabilitation, that provide us the same opportunity. And
yes, I'd like to tell our audience that we've now been joined also by Dr. Mike Noble, and he is part of the sports medicine team, and he's an internist, and his specialty is cardiopulmonary aspects of the body and its conditioning. And in addition to that, we have a phone caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello. I would like to say that this business did not begin in the 70s. It began in the 1960s with President Kennedy.
That's correct.
And his physical fitness program.
Uh-huh.
It might have picked up, you know, and people really began to understand and jump on in the 70s. But he was the one that started it, because we were in such lousy shape here in this country. And the other thing is, you were mentioning monitoring the heart rate and kind of a casual way, and saying, well, you can do it this way and subtract your age and so on. And I think you better damn well monitor that heart rate, because you want to be sure not only that it's high enough and you're getting the benefits you're looking for, but that it's not too high. If it gets too high, you know, there's the old heart attack. That's the worst thing that can happen. Mm-hmm. And the least thing that can happen is you're missing the benefit because your body goes into very serious stress. Right?
Mm-hmm. That's well, entirely correct. I think those are good points. First of all, it was actually President Eisenhower who initiated, created, approved, and very much advertised the President's Council on Youth Physical Fitness. I think President Kennedy, with his own image of youthful vigor, was a dynamic example for all of us. And as he continued the program, why many of us grew up with that program in the high schools, and maybe one of the reasons that part of the American culture is so fitness-oriented now is that we've all, in our age group at least, kind of gone through childhood and early adult life with that kind of emphasis on the part of our governmental leaders. It truly is part of the culture. And your points about watching the heart rate so that it's not too high and so that safety is preserved are really excellent ones. You're entirely correct. And I think along the same lines, it's important that some testing be done before an individual begins an exercise program so that any potential problems are identified and can be watched closely during an exercise program that's specifically prescribed for that individual. Mike, maybe you can tell us some things about that. What are the possible problems and what do you look for? How do you start somebody out on an exercise program? What is that screening process you go through?
Well, the major things I do when I see someone that's interested, a healthy adult, interested in going into an exercise program, is first to decide if they have any cardiac or pulmonary problems, first of all. And so you take a history and see how good a shape they are, if they have any physical disabilities that might preclude one type of exercise or maybe one other one would be their main forte. Then ask them about risk factors for potential premature cardiac disease, smoking, high cholesterol, obesity is a somewhat milder one, hypertension is a major one, diabetes, family history is a major one. Some people think type A personality are very aggressive, overly aggressive, some would say kind of personality. Go into those types of things before ever recommending an exercise program, especially if someone probably over 35 or 40.
Okay, when you read in the magazines about diets, they always say, first see your physician. Do you, in fact, as physicians, have people come and say, I'm about to start an exercise program, I'm about to start a diet, I want to check in with you, or is that something that that most of us sort of disregard?
It's variable. A lot of people do, some people don't. It's kind of like almost anything in the world.
Right.
So, a fair number of people actually do that, and I think that's a very good idea, especially if they are having symptoms of any kind of any chest discomfort, breathing problems, palpitations, things like that, that would go into the cardiac or pulmonary kind of symptomatology. Plus, if they have family history or they're a smoker.
Arthur Ashe is an example of that. Someone who has never smoked, has never been a drinker, who's always been... Well, obviously
excellent.
A world-class athlete, but had a history of cardiac problems in his family. His father had, mm-hmm. at an early age, some heart problems, and Arthur Ashe had a heart attack.
Could I bring up another point here?
Sure.
I've noticed in the aerobics classes that it seems to be kind of a macho thing to keep going as long as you can until you're going to drop, And the young people, most of them don't have to worry about that sort of thing. Of course, you never know. But isn't it true that once they get out of that range that's good for their body and their hearts, you know, above it or below it, that they're not doing their bodies any good at all? I mean, they're missing the whole benefit that they're there for.
I would totally agree with the caller on that. I think that you have to listen to your body when you exercise, whether you're doing aerobic-type exercises or musculoskeletal weight training type exercises. You have to work also within your own limiting capacities, and that varies. Each individual has their own capacity level, and in group exercise like that, it's tough to get one-on-one individualized to your own capacities. I think that when you begin to work outside your capacities, then indeed you open up the incident for musculoskeletal insult to the body, overstress, overuse type syndromes, not only to the musculoskeletal system with your tendonitis and so forth, but also to the cardiopulmonary system as well. And the caller mentioned the importance of monitoring the heart rate and to make sure that that is something that's just not casually passed by, and I agree. And I think that people should monitor that heart rate so that, number one, they get a true training effect, but number two, exercise is indeed safe. So I appreciate the caller bringing up those points.
Mm-hmm. There's, when you're in a peer group situation, a class, you don't want to be the one who's sort of gasping on the floor. And so, I think that your point is well taken, that you need to be, if you're not in the condition that everyone else is, you need to slow down and you need to pay attention to that. We've got somebody's beeper is going off here. We don't know whose it is. We have four physicians, all of whom are wired for sound here.
I might follow up on a good point that Larry made, just as we were talking about how you can go through a screening process to make sure that you're safe from a standpoint of your heart as you begin an exercise program. There's a similar screening process that's useful to go through from the standpoint of the bones and joints, body flexibility, muscle strength, that kind of thing. And a similar kind of screening process is appropriate there to help prevent injuries. That's what we're most interested in, just as the caller points out, preventing those injuries. Larry, maybe you can talk for a moment about the kind of screening process that's appropriate there.
As far as preventing injuries?
Yeah, the musculoskeletal screening process.
Yeah. The components of that is to make sure that there's adequate flexibility. That's one component.
How do you do that?
We do range of motion type testing where we'll have the athlete bend down and touch their toes and monitor their lower back and hamstring flexibility with that type of maneuver. We'll actually ask them to sit and go through a sit and reach type exercise as well to again assess the backside of the body and lower back area for flexibility. The other important things is a strength evaluation to make sure that the athlete doesn't have strength deficits in the various muscle groups or imbalances in the various muscle groups.
So that one group would overcompensate for a weakness in another muscle group.
Exactly, that may predispose them to injury at the adjacent joint, exactly.
Uh-huh. And that can be very sport specific, too. By that I mean that in going over the basic screening examination of a basketball player, you might pay particular attention to flexibility and strength and endurance in the ankles, the part of the body that's most frequently injured in basketball. Whereas by contrast, if you were doing a screening examination for one of our high school wrestlers who are just getting going right now, you might be focusing in particularly on neck strength, which is so important in wrestling and an area of common injury. So that real knowledge of the sport, the kinds of injuries that are sustained in the sports, the kind of training program that can be set up ahead of time to prevent injury is all brought to play as part of the uh-huh. screening process.
Each sport does have its joint or area that gets some particular mm-hmm. stress. And we even have vocabulary now in our society, tennis elbow and...
That's right. Swimmer's knees, swimmer's shoulder, all those things. You know, we talked about adults and their cardiac kinds of problems, and talked about some of the bone and joint flexibility, strength kind of problems. There's some special aspects to the screening examination of the adolescent athlete, that age group. Special things to look for there. And Rex, why don't you tell us the kind of things that you look for in seeing that age group?
Well, generally, when we're dealing with young people, they're basically pretty healthy. But there are some things that you want to screen for that could cause problems. When we take a history for sports participation, we, of course, want to know if there's been any chronic medical problems, particularly things like diabetes or asthma, any chronic illness of that kind. And family history is important to look at with regard to the cardiovascular disease again, particularly if there's been a history of premature death in family members, sudden cardiac death. That might lead you to investigate further the possibility of some congenital syndrome where the offspring could have the same type of problem.
And it might not be obvious until you put some extra stress on it in an athletic
that's
program.
Correct.
I mean, just walking around, they may not be aware that they have some.
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. And then just a general physical examination, focusing on areas that are especially important in sports participation, the neurologic system and the cardiovascular system in particular.
You know, one of the things that we have to decide frequently is how to maintain that already healthful youth athlete as they go through a training process which has a potential for making for medical problems. An example of that is, again, the wrestlers and the issue of weight loss in wrestling. How do you do that safely, help an athlete and a coach?
That is because, for our audience, that wrestling is weight-specific in order to wrestle in certain
weight classes.
Weight classes.
Yeah.
Your weight has to be within certain
That's right, and there can
limits.
Be there can be some real pressure on the athlete and the coach to have the athlete lose weight in order to be able to wrestle at a lower weight class where he has some strength advantage over his competition. And that's another area where the help of Dr. Noble and Dr. Rundquist so useful in maintaining a healthful metabolism in the body while the growing athlete goes through a weight loss process. What has often in the past been a difficult decision to make about how much weight can safely be lost really has a sound scientific basis, and we can set some limits that help to protect the athlete's health during that process.
Because of what you know about the frame of a person, how do you determine what's it?
Yeah, when you're dealing with an adolescent athlete, there's several things to consider. One of them is the body composition, you know, the percentage of what we call lean body mass, the muscle and tendons and bone and so on, and then the fatty tissue. And what you want the individual to lose, of course, is the excess fatty tissue and not any lean body mass, especially during the growing years. And that's the other thing to consider in an adolescent, is that he is going through a growth spurt, and you don't want to do anything on a nutritional basis that's going to affect normal growth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you have to look at the stage of development of the individual involved, and also his body composition.
Mm-hmm. There's a skinfold test to measure that, right?
Yes, there is.
We're only supposed to have 1 inch that we can...
1 centimeter, Patty.
Uh-oh, I'm in trouble.
There's various methods to measure a individual's percent body fat and body composition and so forth. One that's relatively simple and fairly inexpensive and practical is to use the skinfold caliper method that you have alluded to. There's been some problems are rigorously looking at that method regarding its accuracy. In fact, it could be
depressing, actually.
Yeah, vary from day to day, as well as from examiner to examiner. One of the other more accurate ways is to underwater hydrostatic weigh the individual. And that involves a facility or a tank of some kind, a water tank, where a scale and a small little area for the patient to sit underwater is used. And one of the capacities of our sports medicine facility will be to be able to underwater weigh, do underwater weighing, hydrostatic underwater weighing.
You have that
weighing.
Now?
Yes, we do. And we'll be able to do body composition analysis, let's say, on wrestlers, as well as in our adult fitness and cardiac rehab programs, as well as even in our obstetrics rehabilitation programs with ladies that are going through pregnancy that are gaining weight and so forth and are on exercise program, our ability to monitor their percent body fat throughout that course of 9 months. So there's a lot of practical applications to mm-hmm. underwater weighing, and And above all, it's a very accurate method of doing a body composition on an individual.
But that seems like a really complex procedure. Would that only be called for in special instances, or do you think if it is available, you'd advise it for everyone? That kind of extra bad news that we have to hear.
Gee, I think when you're dealing with large numbers of people without special medical problems, that you can fairly accurately estimate percent body fat with the skin fold calipers. And for example, when we see large numbers of wrestlers as a preseason screen, that's certainly an easy and efficient way of handling those athletes. But when it comes to an athlete with special medical problems, the adolescent athlete who also has diabetes, or when it comes to one of our adult fitness athletes who's involved in a cardiac program with Dr. Noble, then the extra accuracy can be important for the elite athlete. And we certainly have a number of national caliber athletes in town. Precise measurement of body composition and custom programming of their training protocol based on their percent body fat is important. That accuracy is important.
Okay, I want to give our phone number. I've been intending to do this. It's 474-5044 for our audience who has any questions or some contributions, as our last caller had. That number is 474-5044, and I would encourage you all to call. Okay, that really points out something that we constantly have athletes who are breaking old records at a really rapid rate. The actual performance level in a lot of sports seems to be increasing, just amazingly. Old records fall every day, and is that because of our superior training, because of our increased sophistication about what is involved with training, what we need to do to train? Is that having an effect on the performance?
Gee,
or is it the Wheaties?
There are a number of things involved there, aren't there? I think you're right. One of it is the advances that we've made in athletic training. And as you so well brought up before, the application of new technology, engineering kinds of technology, to human performance. Certainly, it's in part been the wedding of good medical input and good coaching input together for the optimal performance of the athlete.
So you can prevent injury, and when there is injury, you can treat it more successfully and make sure that athlete doesn't go back too soon or doesn't do the wrong kind of activity.
Well, that's really true, and I think a real crucial aspect of the answer is also the advances that coaches are making all the time. Coaches are able to make use of the same increased level of scientific technology, able to measure progress on different training programs in a much more sophisticated way, make use of a high-speed video, of muscle fiber typing, mm-hmm. All kinds of sophisticated things. A coach really has to be a really broadly educated person, and we're seeing that they are now, and that they can bring all kinds of information to bear on helping their athletes to perform at higher and higher levels. Mm-hmm. They deserve a tremendous amount of credit for the advances we've been seeing.
Hello, we have a caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello. Some time ago, one of the doctors mentioned oxygen in connection with aerobics. I have been told that it's important to breathe deeply while doing exercises. I wonder if that's true. I'll hang up and listen to the answer.
Okay, thank you. Who wants to take that, Larry?
Well, I'll start off by taking that. I've always been an advocate of normal breathing during exercise. The big component there is a lot of athletes have a tendency of holding their breath during exercises when they're going into maximum tension with the body.
You're concentrating.
That's right, and they have a tendency of not breathing normally. Another way of breathing that I recommend also is to exhale upon resistance and inhale upon release of resistance, especially with weight training type programs. So that I'm an advocate of a twofold. Number one is to maintain normal breathing, and that takes a little bit of practice, and it takes a little bit of of cognitive thinking while the individual's exercising, and number two is to exhale upon heavy resistance and inhale upon light resistance as well.
It takes being in shape because you can get into some very shallow breathing patterns if you're not in shape and you're doing some fairly demanding exercise.
I think, I'm not sure if the question was addressing all forms of exercise, but a nice rule of thumb to use in aerobic exercising, like running, is to use what they call the talk test. In other words, you shouldn't exceed your intensity, shouldn't exceed the ability to carry on a conversation with someone next to you.
Really?
That's right.
It's real hard for me when I'm doing an aerobic class to talk. I mean, it's hard for me to just keep up, let alone talk. But
I'd like to add to just a point there. For breathing, I think the body is real smart about that. And if you try to overly breathe deep, you're going to blow off too much CO2 and cause some internal acidosis, alkalosis kind of problems in the body, and you're going to feel poorly. And I think if you just let your body do the work for you, it's very bright about such things, and through stress testing and seeing people exercise, people just naturally get into the right breathing pattern, except for specific circumstances, like Larry was saying, especially with weight training.
Weightlifting.
Yeah, with weight training, it's very easy not to breathe, and I think that's a problem. I think breathing too deep can be a problem, but if you don't think about it too much, I think you'll be...
Your body will find its natural
your body,
level.
Your body will teach you.
We have another caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes?
Hi, I have a question concerning the diabetes you keep mentioning. I was a fairly active recreational athlete in high school and college, and then in the 5 years since college. And with no family history of diabetes, out of the blue last summer, I got diabetes. And I was just wondering if you did have somebody who had a history of diabetes in the family but did not themselves show any signs of it, what precautions that you keep alluding to would you advise?
Thank you for that question. Who wants to take it?
For diabetes, I'm not sure if I understand it, says in the question directly, but let me see if I can get it. If you don't have any symptoms of diabetes, and usually what I think about as symptoms of diabetes is urinating excessively, eating excessively, and still losing weight, and drinking excessively, and then feeling poorly, possibly some eyesight changes. These are some of the warning symptoms of diabetes. Unless you have it, with a family history, it kind of depends when you would develop it in life, what your risks of a first degree relative, say if your brother or if your mom and dad had diabetes. For type 1 or insulin dependent diabetes, where you have to have insulin to survive, usually these are young folks that are lean and not fat. Your chance is actually only probably 1 in 4 or less of developing diabetes. If you're an older person and very overweight, and other overweight persons in the family have diabetes, and usually older, I mean 50s, 60s, and markedly overweight, your chance may be as great as 50% if you're also overweight. So those are the kind of risks in general.
What would you, if someone came to you and said, I have a history of diabetes in my family, what would you say to that person? Could they not proceed as normal until symptoms?
Oh, absolutely not. I wouldn't slow a person down from an exercise program because of a family history of diabetes. And for that matter, even if they had diabetes, I think exercise and diabetes is a cornerstone of therapy, no matter what type of diabetes. Now, it kind of depends on if you're overweight, I wouldn't tell them to be a marathoner if they're a 300-pound person with type 2 diabetes. But the biggest thing, if you want to screen, there are some simple screening tests, checking a urine analysis that's simple to do in a few minutes that can really screen for it very easily.
It's just that if you do have diabetes, you need to take special care with your diet and perhaps insulin, although sometimes it gets
a little more complicated, but exercise still is an incredibly important part of the whole thing we do with folks with diabetes.
Mm-hmm. Are there other diseases like that, Mike, where exercise is a useful part of the therapy for the disease, controlling the symptoms, helping to decrease needs for medication?
Oh, absolutely. Hypertension is probably a prime example because it's so prevalent in the United States. Just for numbers' sake, you can probably bring down blood pressure in healthy people that are able to, say, run a couple miles a day. You know, it might take a while to get to that point, but you can get a large number of people off medications totally, mm-hmm. or at least decrease their medications with high hypertension significantly. And I think that's something that most people really don't realize how important exercise is with that. You could go on with examples of both heart disease and lung disease with exercise that gets a lot more complicated in how far and how fast you can do it, but becomes a very important aspect of that care also.
I think we're becoming really aware that a balanced diet and some judicious exercise can really take the place of medications that we might have been more likely to be taking in the 50s, let's say, because that was more the tendency.
I think that point just bears repeated. That's a real good point.
We have another caller, and I hate to keep people just hanging on the line. Sure. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi. I've had one major disagreement with most aerobics teachers I've had. I've been exercising for like 15 years and various forms of exercise, and I consider myself pretty healthy. But I this pulse rate thing, I always, my heart rate is always above, quite a bit above, and yet my respirations feel fine, and I feel fine, so I don't really agree with them that for my personal body, I should put my pulse rate lower than what makes me feel comfortable when I'm working out.
That's a good point. Is there a variance individual to individual?
Oh, absolutely. There's a large variance. For maximum heart rates, you can sort of give an estimate. A rough estimate is 220 my minus your age is about what your maximum possible heart rate is. If I push as hard as I possibly can, and then usually for aerobics, it's 60 or 70% of that maximum predicted heart rate that you could possibly get into. Is that's what you try to exercise for 20 or 30 minutes, whatever. But that's a safe, a conservative margin where the vast majority of people will not get into trouble if they're continuing in an endurance sort of exercise aerobic program. But that doesn't mean in an individual person that's the best possible pulse for them where they're most working efficiently. And I think that's an individual matter. And you're quite right. You just aren't just Joe average or Mary average. Uh-huh. You have to listen to yourself too. And I think you're quite right in disagreeing there.
They talk about runners reducing their pulse rate over a long time. A really conditioned athlete, their pulse rate becomes less. I mean, I'm not explaining that right,
sure.
Larry?
Oh, that's right, exactly.
For a given submaximal load, they're going to be able to do more work, and their pulse rate's going to be able to stay down lower. Not only the chronic benefits of exercise, you'll see a reduction in the resting heart rate, and you also see the ability to do more work over time, the ability to do more submaximal work over time with the pulse rate staying at a lower rate.
Mm-hmm. So that you can run long distances. But that brings me to a question that I'm going to indulge myself. A very famous runner in peak condition in the prime of his life just dropped dead of a heart attack. Was
Mr. Fix.
Fix. Mm-hmm. Wrote a lot of books about running. What happened?
He had risk factors. He had problems in his family. I believe he had actually previously been a smoker at one time. I'm not absolutely certain of that. But I know he did have a strong family history of premature coronary artery disease. And that's some of the things we've been talking here this morning about, is that when you have risk factors that I have mentioned very briefly before, those are the people that when you get 30, 35, or 40, especially, are the ones that I wouldn't just in general say go out and go for it. I think you ought to have a screening medical evaluation, which may even include a stress test evaluation, if there's those kind of risk factors in the family.
So Fix would come in the category of Arthur Ashe, that it's...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If you look under the surface, there were some potential problems that explained what happened. People that are that are marathon class runners still can die of coronary artery disease, and there's autopsy studies every few years in the major journals that show that that's the case. It doesn't prevent it in 100%. It decreases the numbers, dramatically, but it doesn't prevent
so
it 100%.
So even being in a very good exercise program does not guarantee immortality?
Absolutely.
Precisely, and that's the point I wanted to make. Oftentimes people use running as a panacea for health, and that that's their only component. And okay, I went out and I ran my 4 miles. I can go drink my beer and eat my pizza and not worry about the other components of my system. So that's a problem where just running is used as a panacea for all-encompassing health of the individual, where actually that they need to be looking hard at other components of health besides just running.
I have a friend who says, I run so I can keep smoking. No, you don't like that. Huh? Well, you know, it really does show us that it's a complicated thing, and it requires paying attention to a lot of things in our life, the kind of relationships we have with others, the kind of stress that we have on the job, some regular exercise, a good diet, our own family medical history. And I do think that this recent movement has made all of us, even the most resistant of us, which I have to say I probably put myself in that category. I've been given a body that functions real well, and then I think, well, fine, I don't have to do anything about this. I don't get sick. I have a lot of energy, and I really think I'm mistaken about that. Mm-hmm. I think I need to get into some regular exercise program, and it's hard in Fairbanks. I'm not saying that there aren't lots of things available, but when it's cold and when it's dark and when driving around town is difficult, you have to make a special effort. It's not like living in Southern California where it's not a problem to incorporate it in your daily life. I think we have to acknowledge that you really have to make an effort here to do something.
It's true, but it's an effort worth making. And as you say, it's a complex issue, and one of the best things that's happened to the medical profession, the coaching professions, is that all the different experts are really putting their heads together now. They're working together as a group to give that kind of complex advice to the individual.
Yeah, I think that's obvious from the four of you here, and that we have this Denali Sports Medicine Center, is that it's becoming a multidisciplined process, and you've referred several times to the work that you do with trainers and with coaches, and so it isn't a question of the coach just being out here and saying, go for it, push yourself as far as possible, and then you having, as doctors, to pick up the pieces and just deal with the injury after the fact, that it's really a group effort to prevent it and to train. And
that's right. That's really well said. We're all working together to maintain the health and the optimal performance of the athlete, and that really requires a good communication between the coaches, the physicians, the trainers, the exercise physiologists. We all have the same goal, and we work together on that. That's the way it should be.
Do you think it's going to, in fact, or has been, extending the amount of performance years that athletes are capable of, instead of having, it used to be in football, for example, in the pros, that there was 5 years was an average career, and before they were just hobbling around.
Well, I think there's some classic examples out there, not on the professional level as well as other levels, just to take in Steve Carlton, one of the best pitchers in the National Baseball League, who has, been very outspoken about extending his career through knotless training techniques and weight training and the health of his body. Carl Yastrzemski, a great New Englander, spent many years with the Boston Red Sox, again was able to extend his career, helped by the designated hitter rule, of course, but was able to extend his careers as well. A person that's really close to my heart, being from Chicago, is Walter Payton, a very durable mm-hmm. individual who has, again, had the ability to stay injury-free through rigorous training techniques and advancements and so forth. I think we were talking about optimizing the performance of various athletes across the country, and we alluded to the fact that there's been an increase in techniques, biomechanics, and coaching. I think other things such as Olympic training sites across the country. A classic example is right in our community here with the luge run, and that our abilities to see that is a component of the Winter Games, and we need to improve the performance of our athletes. So various training sites across the country have really helped us out as well.
More access, as yeah. Eastern European countries have, to really good professional training for athletes from a real early age, not just those that can afford it, but a lot more sense that training really is important. We have another caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, I just was interested in commenting to the fellow that called in about his diabetes. Seemed like I've known several young people and even one infant that developed diabetes. And it seemed like still when the question is brought up, most physicians don't seem aware of the nutritional aspects that have been reported for since the 50s in the biochemical journals, nutritional journals. And Adele Davis's book, Let's Get Well, has a whole chapter on diabetes. And she specifically mentions a 19-year-old college athlete who was able to completely go off insulin by changing his diet. Only in times of stress he'd have to have 10 or 15 units. And he was taking in the beginning, 40 units mm-hmm. daily. And basically it involves getting rid of, getting the B vitamins and the B6, which influence the xanthoic acid production. And we get our B vitamins in our whole grains, and nobody eats whole grains anymore because they're refined. And, of course, mm-hmm. supplements are possible. And getting rid of the saturated fats and going to and avoiding hydrogenated fats, the margarine mm-hmm. and the treated oils, and going back to natural sources.
I think we're getting a greater awareness of that. Does someone want to react to that here?
Well, I think diet, I agree that diet is a very important part of diabetes, and some people can get off insulin or get off what we call oral hypoglycemic pills that bring up the amount of insulin in the body so you can bring down your blood sugar. And diet in certain individuals can be the biggest thing about it. It can be the whole treatment. I would have to say that it might be an oversimplification for a lot of people. And diabetes is such a complex issue. And there's different kinds of diabetes. It isn't just one disease. That diet, I think, I just couldn't spend enough time on the radio explaining
it all. There isn't a one way for,
no.
Just as we had that woman caller who called in and said that her heart rate during exercise is higher than other people in the class, I think that we also know that about diseases. You go in and a physician says, okay, you're going to have this surgery, you're going to feel this way, you're going to be in the hospital this long, and we find some people take much longer to recover, and some people, of course, it's much quicker. I had a little surgery, and I said, well, my doctor, I said, this is really a low expectation. I feel great now. And he was saying, well, you can take a shopping trip 4 weeks later or something. I said, well, that's ridiculous. I was washing cars in a week. But it's just a great discrepancy between individuals and their capacity to heal and their background, I would assume.
Well, basically, though, there's just one other book I wanted to mention, too, that when the people like the gentleman called in, what should I do if I have diabetes in the family? And they say, well, eat a good diet. And people have no idea what a good diet is.
Mm-hmm.
William Dufty in Sugar Blues described at length what problems mm-hmm. that he had with diabetes and how he, once you start taking insulin, it's very difficult to reverse it. But people who know that in their family, who see people around them, there are many things you can do preventatively.
Mm-hmm.
And he describes at length the natural diet is basically whole grains, brown rice, and B vitamin
sources.
I agree 100% about your idea of prevention for especially for something like diabetes. It's the only problem I find in my practice, though, it's a lot easier said than done, and I can tell people, but generally folks don't like to hear it until they find that they're sick enough or they're tired enough from the problems they have, from whatever they got themselves into, that then they want to sort of do remedial therapy. They don't want to do it preventatively.
You know,
lot of people don't, and that's what this whole talk show is about.
And sometimes we still are in that mentality that I can take a pill and I don't have to take an active part in this maintenance of my body, that there might be some really easy thing that I can do just sort of on my way out the door, and we've discovered that that's not true. We have a very short amount of time. I would like to give you an opportunity to say something that I might have missed here in this questioning. Is there another point that we need to make here? It's clear to me that it's a very good idea to see your physician before you start on an active athletic program and make sure that you're in condition, and that to start slow and work up is important. But clearly, all of you are strong advocates for a healthy, balanced diet and some continual and regular exercise, 3 times a week minimum, right? For at least 15 minutes.
That's correct.
That's the minimum. That's mm-hmm. the absolute minimum. Any other points that you would like to add to that?
We've been talking about a team of people working together to maintain the health and the athletic performance of athletes in the community. And we haven't said it specifically, but it's critically important that the athlete is the most important member of that team. And just as the athletes in the community in Fairbanks are unusual in the commitment they've made to athletes, we're glad to be able to equal that commitment to maintaining their health and their performance.
Well, I hope you all keep active this winter so we don't add those usual pounds that are easy to add during the winter. I thank you all for joining me. Doctors from the Denali Sports Medicine Center, this has been the Home Fires Radio Show. I've been your host, Patty Kostelic. Our executive producer is Carla Tonella. Have a very good week.
Listening to KUAC FM in Fairbanks, it's now 12 noon.
Chautauqua Institution, a summertime center for the arts, education, religion, and recreation. Located in the southwestern corner of New York State on beautiful Chautauqua Lake, Chautauqua Institution offers a richly woven tapestry of programs for personal enrichment. Here is a more than century-old unique summer community, rich in its tradition of encouraging spiritual, mental, and physical growth. The rainbow of activities brings thousands here for the many special activities every day. And for one such activity, Chautauquans walk down the narrow tree-lined lanes, past the old Victorian cottages, past the graceful hotels with their broad porches for relaxing, to the amphitheater for the weekday morning lecture series. The original amphitheater was built in 1879, and at the time was acclaimed as the perfect place for public speaking. It is to the amphitheater's speakers platform that outstanding leaders and thinkers in contemporary literature, as well as science, medicine, social, and political affairs, have come. Our program today comes from the 1984 summer season of the Chautauqua Institution. We'll hear from one of America's truly unique philosophers. Our speaker today is humorist, satirist, author, radio and television personality, and actor Gene Shepherd. Gene Shepherd takes us today on one of his typical, rambling, classic Shepherdian reflections of life. We'll hear about Indiana, Oldsmobiles, how day people are different from night people, how Shepherd became a humorist, and his early education. While there was no previously announced topic, and often there does not seem to be an apparent topic anyway with Gene Shepherd, he tells us that he is speaking...